So welcome to this session of your sacred texts course. Before we start today, I'm going to talk about rabbinic literature, but before we start, what are your associations when you hear the term rabbi? What is a rabbi? Some of you might be familiar with rabbis nowadays. Yes, yes.
A leader of the community, Jewish community.
Right, a leader of the Jewish community, right. And what does he do as a leader of the Jewish community?
He does always inspire the Jewish couples to get, for example, get married. Or
yes.
Something going on in their marriage or,
He advises people on various areas of life and religion. And he's also associated with the synagogue. Sometimes he gives a sermon in the synagogue. And so when we come to talk about rabbis in antiquity, what is important is not to superimpose the image of rabbis nowadays on ancient rabbis. Because in antiquity, to be a rabbi was quite different from being a rabbi nowadays, as we will see, although there are also some similarities. So before I'm going to talk about rabbinic literature, first I'm going to talk about the context in which rabbis created traditions and in which they were active. So first we have to look at the historical context then. So who were rabbis in antiquity? So the main aspect of being a rabbi in antiquity was to study Torah and to be an expert in Torah study. What is the Torah? I've heard that you have not had a session yet on the Bible. So when I use the term Torah, what do I mean by Torah? Is there anyone who knows what the Torah is? Yes? Yes, exactly, exactly. So the Torah is the same as the so-called Pentateuch, a term which is usually used in theology and in New Testament studies. So it's the first five books of Moses, the first part of the Hebrew Bible. And what is important is that this part was most important to rabbis in antiquity. It was the most sacred part, because it contained religious law. And so rabbis were, first of all, experts in the five books of Moses, in the exegesis and interpretation of the five books of Moses. And they emerged in Jewish society after the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE. So I don't know to what extent you know about Judaism before 70. Before 70, there was a temple in Jerusalem, and religious practice was very much focused on the temple, and priests were the main religious authorities. And the main religious practice was to bring sacrifices, and usually priests brought sacrifices on behalf of the entire community. So now in 70 CE, when the Romans destroyed the temple, there was a certain vacuum within Jewish society with regard to religious practice. And many contemporaries of rabbis didn't know how to go about living a life which was pleasing to God. And so at that point, rabbis stepped in and they replaced priests as the main religious authorities, as the self-styled experts in the religious tradition. And the text of the Bible now became the main heritage from pre-70 times. That was the main body of Jewish tradition, and study of the Torah then replaced sacrifice in the temple. So study of the Torah became the main religious practice after 70 CE, and rabbis were the main authorities in interpreting the Torah. What is also important is that unlike rabbis nowadays, in antiquity, rabbis were not communal authorities as such, and they were also not leaders of synagogues, but they were really like individual wise men, in Hebrew. Does anyone know Hebrew here? So wise man in Hebrew means chacham, and rabbis call themselves chachamim, which is a plural form, which means wise men. So there were individual wise men learned in the interpretation of the Torah who had more or less small circles of disciples. And they were interlinked, they had networks of colleagues, friends, with whom they discussed and disputed various aspects of rabbinic law and of Bible interpretation. You could say that rabbis were sort of intellectual elite discussing things amongst each other and with their disciples, but they also had a certain function within the larger Jewish community. Namely, they had sympathizers amongst other Jews who asked them for advice. So they stepped into this vacuum left by the destruction of the temple and now served as intermediaries between the religious tradition on the one hand and the ordinary person who didn't know how to act properly and then came to a rabbi to ask him for advice. And what is also important is that this advice and the expertise of rabbis was in all areas of daily life. It wasn't limited to, say, festival observance or matters of purity or impurity, but it also included, as already mentioned, family issues such as marriage and divorce, so-called family purity, but also various aspects of civil law, such as, for example, damages which occurred, for example, with the animals of one's neighbor, or, for example, if a floor in a house broke down and the lower story became damaged. So they dealt with all aspects of daily life. With regard to timing, so we are talking generally about the time period after 70, between 70, say, and roughly 500. And within this time period, chronologically, we distinguish between two levels. So the earlier level are the so-called Tanaim. And the Tana means to teach, and a Tana is a teacher. And they were rabbis who lived between 70 and 200 CE. And the next layer are the so-called Amoraim. The singular term is Amora, and they are rabbis who lived between 200 and the middle of the 5th century CE. And what is important also is that with regard to dating, this is the only distinction we can make with regard to dating. So one talks about Tanaitic versus Amoraic documents, meaning Tanaitic documents including traditions of rabbis who lived between 70 and 200, and Amoraic documents are documents which have traditions of rabbis who lived between 70 and 450. But one cannot date traditions accurately on the basis of attributions to particular rabbis. So for example, if, say, Rabbi Yochanan lived around 300, we know that he lived around 300, and something is attributed to Rabbi Yochanan, for example, Rabbi Yochanan said this and that, nevertheless, we cannot say that these are the words of Rabbi Yochanan. Why is that so? Why could there be these problems with attributions? Why is dating problematic? Dating according to attributions. It's actually, I'm going to talk about this more in the next slide. It's because of oral tradition. And traditions were transmitted by the students of a rabbi. So they were transmitted from one generation to the next. And this means that in oral tradition, there is no accurate wording, but views and statements are always reformulated. And so one cannot say that this is exactly, these are exactly the words of a particular rabbi. So on the one hand, we have the dating differences here. The earlier rabbinic traditions are the Taitic material and the later are the Amoraic. The other major distinction is between Palestine and Babylonia. So there was a rabbinic movement. The rabbinic movement actually started in Palestine after 70 CE in Roman times. And from the 3rd century onwards, it expanded to Babylonia. And so Palestine at that time was part of the Roman Empire, and later from the 4th century onwards, part of the Byzantine Empire. So Palestine and all rabbinic literature that developed in Palestine developed in a Greco-Roman context, in a context that was impacted by Greco-Roman culture. So we always have to view it within this Greco-Roman context. But with regard to Babylonia, the situation is different, because in Babylonia, Mesopotamia, that was part of Persia at that time, of Sasanian Persia, and so the culture was not Greco-Roman. Does anyone know what cultural tradition and religious traditions were present in Babylonia in late antiquity? Here I have already written Zoroastrianism, but at least in late antiquity there were also other religious traditions, and Babylonia was very multicultural. Yes, exactly. Right. Right. Yes.
And for some reason also a bit of Hinduism and Buddhism too.
Right. So that is very important, that it was many different religions. And?
Like paganism.
Right. So that was actually part of the so-called, or one of the so-called Silk routes towards Asia, went through Babylonia. And so not only business people, but also other traders crossed and transferred this area, but there were also many people who were settled there. And as you already mentioned, Eastern Christianity, various groups of Eastern Christianity were located there, and also Manichaeans, and also some Asians who did then were on these trade routes. So you have to imagine it as a very multicultural society. So this was the general historical context then in which rabbinic literature developed. And so always keep in mind, on the one hand, the distinction between Tanaitic and Amoraic, and between Palestinian and Babylonian with regard to the different cultural contexts. So when we talk about rabbinic literature then, classical rabbinic literature contains traditions of Tanaim and Amoraim who lived between 70 and 450 CE. So of rabbis who lived between 70 and 450. And one aspect that is also important here, which I probably forgot to list here, is that Tanaitic literature and traditions are always in Hebrew, in the so-called Mishnaic Hebrew, and Amoraic traditions are in Aramaic. So what about Aramaic? Why the distinction between Hebrew and Aramaic? What was the significance of Hebrew at this time? What do you associate with Hebrew? Was Hebrew the common language of Jews in Rome, Palestine? Did they talk amongst themselves in Hebrew? No, they actually spoke Aramaic amongst themselves. And Aramaic was at that time and for some centuries already the common colloquial language, not only of Jews, but also of other people who lived in the Near East and also Middle East at that time. And Hebrew was obviously the language of the Bible, of the Torah, and of the temple. So Hebrew was very much, in the first century, it was very much a religious language associated with the Torah and the temple, but it was not a spoken language. And that is also why rabbinic texts written in Hebrew are usually seen as being written in some kind of artificial Hebrew, which is not really a spoken language at that time. So Tanaitic traditions and Tanaitic documents are in Hebrew, and Amoraic documents and Amoraic traditions are in Aramaic. But I have to complicate this a little bit, because as mentioned, Amoraic documents contain also Tanaitic traditions. So they have both Hebrew and Aramaic texts. But the good thing is that you can usually identify the Tanaitic texts by seeing that they are written in Hebrew rather than Aramaic. Obviously, that is not good for someone who looks at the translations only, because obviously the translation doesn't indicate whether something is written in Hebrew or Aramaic. But if you looked at the texts in their original, and perhaps some of you are planning to eventually do so, then you can easily distinguish between the earlier and the later material by just looking at the language they are formulated in. So classical rabbinic documents were then edited between 200 CE, and the Mishnah is the earliest rabbinic document, and I'm going to talk more about it later. And the 6th to 7th century, the Babylonian Talmud is the latest document. And so the Mishnah, edited around 200, has Tanaitic traditions, but you see that it was compiled only around 200, so 130 years after the rabbis to whom certain traditions are attributed lived. So you can imagine that it doesn't really preserve their exact formulations. Also important is that all rabbinic documents are anonymous. We don't know who exactly the editors are, and these are compilations, they are not authored documents. So those of you who know of other classical writings, you know that they are usually attributed to certain authors. There is not that much anonymous work around, but can you think of any other anonymous compilations of antiquity? Compilations which have traditions from many different centuries attributed sometimes to different people, and then they were edited, but we don't know exactly who the editors were. Yes? Yes, exactly. Right. Yes, so Mark and Matthew and Luke, so they also contain traditions which are also usually seen as orally transmitted traditions, parables and various other forms. And then at some stage they were edited, and we don't know exactly when and by whom. So they are also compilations. Does anyone know of any late antique compilations? Christian compilations, say the 4th, 5th century CE. Have you ever heard of the so-called apophthegmata patrum, which are collections of traditions associated with desert fathers in Egypt? They are also transmitted anonymously, and they have stories and statements associated with different individual desert fathers. So that is also would be a body of comparative material with regard to this type of literature. So they are basically like mosaics, which have traditions from hundreds of years, which were brought together at some stage and then were transmitted in written form. In rabbinic documents, then, the views, teachings, and stories about many different rabbis stand side by side. And the question is, why is that so? And the Gospels were mentioned, and in contrast to rabbinic literature, the Gospels, all of the material focuses on Jesus. So there is a clear focus on Jesus, although we have different traditions which were transmitted in different circles and then eventually brought together, but with regard to rabbinic documents, there is not the focus on one particular rabbi. So that is one of the most important differences, that here we have a collection of traditions associated with, say, 20 rabbis of each generation, and they all stand side by side. None is given preference over any other. And so this is probably to create the image of the rabbinic movement as a pluralistic and democratic movement where all views counted the same. So the editors did not elevate one particular rabbi, but they gave all rabbis the same kind of voice. So here there is an overview over the different types of genres. What is a genre? When I talk about a genre, what is a literary genre? And how does it differ from a form, a literary form? So a genre would be the type of literature which a compilation or a larger work has, whereas a literary form would be the form of, say, a story or a parable or a statement. So the form refers to a smaller literary unit, and the genre is the larger form. And so generally, or the main distinction here we are dealing with here is between the Mishnah, which consists mainly of halakha or religious law, and Midrash, which is biblical exegesis. And often students confuse these terms, Mishnah and Midrash. So the term Midrash comes from Drash in Hebrew, which means to interpret, to explain. And Mishnah comes from Shana, which means teaching. And so the Mishnah is the basis then of various other documents, which all focus more on religious law, but also contain narrative traditions. So the Mishnah, edited around 200 CE, is then followed by the Tosefta. Tosefta literally translated means edition. And the Tosefta contains more additional material to the Mishnah. And the relationship between the Mishnah and Tosefta is not entirely clear. What is important is that the Talmuds, both the Palestinian Talmud, which is also called Talmud Yerushalmi, and the Babylonian Talmud, which is called Talmud Bavli, they are commentaries on the Mishnah. So all of this literature, which is here on the left-hand side, is not primarily oriented on the Bible. But in all of this literature, rabbis develop their own system of religious law. So the Talmuds are then commentaries on the Mishnah, and the Mishnah, and they are also organized according to the structure of the Mishnah, which means the Mishnah is divided into orders and tractates, and the Talmud are divided into the same kind of orders and tractates. So this is very different from Midrash. Remember, from Drash, to explain or interpret. And the Midrash is biblical exegesis. And here we distinguish between Tanaitic Midrashim, that is the early Midrashim, which are written in Hebrew, which are listed here, Mechilta, Zifra on Leviticus, and Zifre Deuteronomy, and the so-called Amoraic Midrashim, written in Aramaic, which date to the 4th to 5th century CE. And the Amoraic Midrashim, Genesis Rabbah and Leviticus Rabbah, they are much more focused also on narrative texts. And then there are later Midrashim from the early Middle Ages, which are listed below. What can you, if you look at the Midrashim here, what kind of books of the Bible do they focus on? Yes? Yes, exactly. So they all focus on books of the Torah, on Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, on these five books of Moses. And that is because the Torah was held in much higher esteem than the rest of the books of the Bible. And so we don't actually have any Midrash on any of the other books from antiquity, from the so-called classical rabbinic period. So there is, for example, a midrash called Psalms Rabbah or Song of Songs Rabbah, but these are usually dated to the Middle Ages. They are not part of the classical rabbinic midrash. So it's generally only Genesis Rabbah and Leviticus Rabbah, which are datable to the 4th to 5th centuries. I mentioned already the importance of oral transmission, and that is because ancient Jewish society and ancient society in general has to be imagined as a so-called oral society. So what does an oral society mean? How does it differ from our society nowadays? So it means that very few people would have been literate. With regard to Roman society, William Harris has estimated that probably only 10% or so of males were literate, and the number of women who were literate would have been much smaller, maybe only like 2% or something. And in Jewish society, especially in Roman Palestine, because it was not so much involved in administrative issues, the number of people who were literate was probably even smaller than in Roman society or in Egyptian society, which had a large administrative apparatus. So this means that very few people had actually access to writing. They couldn't write, and they could also not read, usually not read what was written. And so we don't even know, for example, whether all rabbis were able to write, because writing was a technical skill which was associated with scribes. And for example, it also was not a status marker. Even wealthy people, they had their secretaries. They didn't need to be able to write anything but their names. So writing in general was very rarely used. But it was especially also not used by scholars and sages, not only by religious scholars, but also by philosophers. They also didn't use writing that much. But philosophers also taught their students usually orally. And so both teaching and also discussions amongst colleagues would have been conducted orally. And what would you say, what are the differences between written and oral transmission of traditions? Yes? Yes, it's much more flexible, isn't it? Yeah. It can much more be adapted to new circumstances, and one would expect more reformulation. Whereas in writing, things are fixed. The other thing, there is another important aspect with regard to oral transmission and teaching, namely that it connected students to their teachers. They couldn't go away with a book and then study by themselves, but they were really dependent on the presence of a certain teacher. So once these works were put into writing, the kind of study practice would have changed a lot, because the books, the written material, could be taken away and then it could be reinterpreted. And also another aspect is that with regard to oral transmission, a student would then study with one particular teacher, and he could then, and I have to say he, because I haven't mentioned that yet, but all of the students or disciples of rabbis were males. So the student could then go and study, say, with another rabbi after a few years. But if you have a book, for example, the Mishnah or the Talmud, there you have traditions associated with many different rabbis collected. So once you have the many different opinions, then you see differences of opinion, which you wouldn't actually notice if you hear only the views of one particular teacher. So that is another difference here. So also in philosophical schools, the living voice of the teacher was considered superior to any texts, and rabbis and philosophers actually discouraged students from taking notes. Then there is this concept of oral Torah, which is probably partly based on the fact that rabbinic traditions were mainly transmitted orally. So rabbis call the Hebrew Bible the so-called written Torah, and they call their own tradition the oral Torah. And this concept of written and oral Torah would have served, on the one hand, to connect the two, to say that rabbinic teachings are also traceable back to Moses at Sinai and are sacred. They are divinely inspired Torah. They are as valuable as the written Torah. So it legitimizes rabbinic opinions and claims that they are divinely inspired. But on the other hand, there is this division here between written and oral, so it's also a distinction made between one body of tradition and the other. The Hebrew Bible as a base text and rabbinic traditions as the interpretation. As already mentioned, students were discouraged from taking notes, but on the other hand, some students may actually have taken notes. So when these works were edited, the editors probably had written and oral material available. That is a bit strange now because the image is actually missing here. Here I have, isn't that strange?
That is strange.
I hope it's not with all of them. So maybe after the break we can have the images. Actually here on the right hand side there was a manuscript. So the images of the manuscripts of the Talmud stem from the 10th century and later, although there are a few earlier fragments which might have been created in the 5th, 6th century CE. But we don't have the entire texts for the earlier period. Unfortunately, we don't have the image here, because then I would have asked you, although you don't know Hebrew, what it looks like, and you would have noticed that the text is one long string of letters, so there is no interruption, there is no punctuation in the text, and there are also no vowels, and that would have shown you that it would have been very difficult to read these texts. So you would need a lot of practice, you would need to memorize texts and phrases in order to be able to actually make sense of the texts. And rabbis in primary education, students would learn how to memorize texts, and memorization in antiquity was practiced much more than nowadays.